Theta, Epsilon, Omicron, Sigma. And people would go, we've never heard of that fraternity before. Yeah, probably not. Well, here we are, and we're going to talk about the Arians. A-R-I-A-N-S, not A-R-Y-A-N-S. Not the really nasty skinhead people living in northern Idaho. But Arians, who were followers of a man named Arius, hence the name, in the 4th century in Alexandria. And just a little bit about Arius. He was an incredibly popular preacher, just after Constantine took power. So Constantine took power about 313, 321 was the Act of Toleration, and 325 is where we are crucially, is the Council of Nicaea, which was called specifically to address the Arian heresy and to find a way to define these people out of the church with that. Now, I'm going to present a very different understanding of the Arian controversy than is usually understood. It's usually understood as a radical monotheism. And in fact, the folks that trace their ancestry, the modern folks that trace their ancestry back to the Arians are the Unitarians. So it's usually conceived of as, well, these are just, Arius was just a bunch of, he was a very logician kind of person who was this ethereal, theological, radical monotheist kind of understanding. And partly because of how it got defined. Because what's the first article of the creed, of almost any creed? I believe in God. So when you start there, that's where the argument begins. And really what I think, and I'm getting this from folks that I had as teachers in seminary, Denny Groh, who with a book, a man named Bob Gregg, wrote a book called Early Arianism, where they argued that the issue around Arianism really, truly was not radical monotheism, but soteriology, or how are we saved? The understanding of salvation and the different way that it came in. That's the real crucial issue in the crux, and why Arianism was so popular. Because if it was just this esoteric, theological, logician's kind of flight about monotheism, it wouldn't have been as popular as it was on the streets. And Arianism was incredibly popular, and it spread. And in fact, most of the Germanic tribes that came down in the 5th century to sack Rome and the Western civilization, almost all of them, if they had been converted to Christianity, were converted to Arian Christianity. Which also did not endear them with that. But the question that's traditionally used is the Son eternal as the Father? That's usually the question that is addressed as Arian's major point. Is the Son eternal as the Father? Alexander the Bishop said yes, and Arius said no. What was being discussed was not whether the one who became incarnate in Jesus existed before the incarnation. On this point, they were all in agreement that the Son existed before the incarnation. The question was rather, this one existed from all eternity. The debate grew very bitter. Arius insisted on his position. Alexander finally excommunicated him. But the conflict spilled out into the thousands of Christians in Alexandria, because Arius was, as I said, an incredibly popular preacher, and the people were like, how dare the bishop excommunicate him with it? And so someone composed a bunch of little ditties, little songs that they would sing as they would go along, they would be chanted in the streets as a protest against Bishop Alexander's actions. And so, literally, you had these demonstrations of people with placards singing their little ditties. There was when he was not. I just love this vision of these demonstrations against it. Such commotion that was caused that the emperor thought it was advisable to intervene in this conflict. And so he sent Bishop Hostius, who tried to mediate, but he reported back to Constantine that there was no reconciling the views, that there's just no way that they were going to come together. And so Constantine, along with the bishops, calls the Council of Nicaea, which were 300 bishops came together. Arius was not a bishop, therefore he was not part of the Council of Nicaea, but he had a lot of representatives because there were a number of bishops who happened to agree with Arius and Arius's understanding with that. I have, to see the traditional understandings, some handouts. We'll always give you primary source handouts so you can read. Again, because Arius, thank you, Chris, because Arius is a heretic, we don't have a whole lot of left of what he wrote, but we have a few of the letters that he wrote to people. Wake up, Eric. You missed your handout. There you go. Got one? Just maybe put them on a sign in case anybody comes in. So the first one is Arius' letter to Eusebius of Nicodemia. And Eusebius is actually a supporter of Arius. And so he's writing, and you get this nice flowery language of, to the most longed for Lord, faithful man of God, Orthodox Eusebius. And so he wants to stress that, in fact, he is, in fact, of right belief. Remember, Orthodox with a small O means just right belief. Arius, who is unjustly persecuted by Pope Alexander on account of all the prevailing truth which you also protect, sends greetings in the Lord. It's a wonderful way to start a letter. I mean, next time I write, I may write like this. Who knows? So since my dad was coming along, I thought I'd send, a long letter. With that, to remind you about all my love and all these things. And to tell you that the bishop greatly pillages us and persecutes us, and invoking all things moves against us so that he might drive us as godless men from the city. All this because we do not agree with him when he states in public, always God, always Son. At the same time, Father, at the same time, Son. Son ingenerably coexists with God, ever begotten, ungenerated, created, neither in thought nor in some moment of time does God perceive the Son. Always God, always Son. The Son is from God himself. And then it says, since that, all these other people throughout you say that God is without beginning, exists before the Son. And so he's trying to say, see, look, all these people, all these nice early church writers, all these previous people, all agree with me that God exists before the Son with that. If the heretics should threaten us with myriads of death, we are not able to hear these impieties. So, in fact, Arius is calling the people who are saying, calling Bishop Alexander a heretic in there. But what is it that we say or think? And then on the back, we teach that the Son is not unbegotten. And actually, this, I think, is a wrong translation of the Greek. It's the way that the Greek is usually, the word is monogenes. Actually, this time I thought I'd actually write on the board.
Joanne?
Yeah?
Some say that he is a belching. Can you...
Like this?
I guess.
One wonders.
One wonders.
Just one exactly.
This is a transliteration of a of the Greek Monogenes. And Monogenes is almost always, and by the Orthodox, and always by the Orthodox Church, as mono only genes begotten. And so that it's translated only begotten son, and that's where you read it. When Arius translates it, because mono can be only or it can be first. And so I think that this translation of the Greek is not correct. And I think it should say first begotten with that, or a portion of the unbegotten in any manner from any substratum, but that by the will and the counsel of the Father, he subsisted before times and ages full of grace and truth, God only begotten, unchangeable. And before he was begotten or created or defined or established, he was not. So he said, if in fact you're going to talk about the fact that the Son was begotten, the Son had to be begotten, had to be begotten at some point in time, or it doesn't make any sense to say that. And that it's not that the Son was begotten or first begotten, and for Arius it's the firstborn of all creatures, and picks up the Pauline language of pioneer and perfecter with that.
Could you say that again? It picks up the Pauline?
The Pauline understanding of pioneer. Paul talks about Jesus as being the pioneer and perfecter of our faith in a number of letters. And so it's, I actually think that the Arians are better biblical exegetes. They really are better at interpreting the scripture stuff than Athanasius was or Alexander. But those are the guys that won with that. And I know it's a little hard because it is that philosophical language, because Arius is responding to the accusations that are being made, and the only way that we get some of the other stuff is pulling it out of Athanasius's treatise against the Arians, and I've got a few quotations that I'll do a little bit later. But then Arius's letter to Alexander of Alexandria. Now here's the guy who's excommunicated him. And so he says, you know, we know one God, alone, unbegotten, alone, everlasting, alone, without beginning. So, you know, God is alone in all of these things. God is alone, without, alone master, judge of all, manager, director, immutable, unchangeable, just and good, God of law, prophets, and New Testament, who begot, and again, only begotten, I think it's first begotten, Son, before eternal times, through whom he made the ages and everything. But he begot him, not in appearance, but in truth. So, I mean, it's, again, it's that sense of if the Son is begotten, has to be begotten at some point in time. That only God is unbegotten.
Isn't there a scripture, begotten of the Father?
Yeah.
Or is that the Creed?
That's the Creed. It's the Creed, and that's why they, that's what the Creed, that's, you know, the Creed says that. And Arius says, don't you see the illogic of that? And they're like, no. with that. Perfect creature of God. Of that sense. I'm sorry, I had to photocopy these from books that I've already scribbled all over. So you get what I thought was important. And you can ignore that if you want. With that, but as we, down toward the bottom, says, but as we say, he was created by the will of God before times and ages, and he received life, being, and glories from the Father, as the Father has shared them with him. So it's that sense that Christ was monogenes, was in fact begotten in a certain time by God's will. God wills to create the Son. And God is not Father until God creates the Son. And so so Arius will talk about God and not talk about God as Father until later, until after the Son is begotten. Because before then, it's only God. With that. And then the and then as it goes on, for he's not everlasting, nor co-everlasting, or unbegotten with the Father, nor does he have being with the Father. And that's again, he's arguing with the word that's going to be chosen, and I need to say a totally non-scriptural word that's being chosen for the Nicene Creed, homoousia. That's where it says, nor does he have being with the Father. Here's your little Greek lesson for the day. Homo in Greek means... No, that's Latin. Homo in Greek means same. It's where the term homosexuality comes from. Same sex. Homo means same. Ousia is being in Greek. So same in being or same in... And interestingly enough, it doesn't mean essence. It doesn't mean substance until Athanasius argues that it does mean substance. It usually means being. But this is the word that that comes that's in we believe in God and in Jesus, light of light, God, true God from true God, begotten, not made, one in being with the Father. That's the homoousia. They tried all kinds of other names or all other kinds of words, and one of the ones they tried was homoiousia. See, there's just one little letter difference, and that's of like substance. And the Arians were willing to say that.
Like.
Of like substance, because we're all part of God, and we're all like substance. Now, see, it's one little letter that's different. Do you know what an I is called in Greek? Iota.
One
and
iota.
The phrase that we have that says it doesn't make one iota difference comes from this, but it makes all the difference in the world. And so we've turned that phrase around.
So just a question, if Jesus was the first begotten, not the only begotten, does that mean we are all then?
Yes.
Begotten?
Yes. Jesus is the Son of God, as we can all be sons and daughters of God. What Arius has is what we refer to as an adoptionist Christology. Is that Jesus was born, really, really, really born, really human type person. And grew, and they pick out the phrases, and it says, how can Jesus be God if in Luke it says he grows in wisdom and stature and favor with God? How do you grow in wisdom and stature and favor with God if in fact you're already God? so what the Arians are stressing, and the other one is is the Arius to Constantine saying, we're being persecuted and please don't persecute us because really we make more sense than they do. But again, I give you these ones because that it pictures the usual understanding of what Arius is about. But I want to say that it really does begin not as a debate over God as a first principle or some reductionist logic stuff about biblical faith, but a clash between two positive schemes of salvation. And there are three key features that reveal the structure of Arian soteriology. One is the language of fatherhood and sonship, which for the Arians is an adoptive understanding rather than a biological bond. Sonship for the Arians is a conferred grace. You get it by trying to make your will one with God's will. And that's Jesus' entire life is his pattern of making his will one with God's will. And that Jesus could have sinned, but didn't. And they look at the temptations and say, that if Jesus faced the temptations and couldn't have given in to them, then it's a sham. Then why have them? Jesus could have given in to the temptations, but did not. And because he did not and had the capacity and the ability not to do that, so do we. Because for the Arians, everything that is said about Jesus has to be able to be said about us. For the Orthodox Church, everything that's said about Jesus has to be able to be said about God. And you see the vast difference with that? And when the Orthodox Church talks about when Jesus says in John, I and the Father are one, it doesn't say in there one what.
He's saying Orthodox, big O or little O?
Little O. Every time, all the time I'm going to be talking, all week, when I say Orthodox, it'll be little O, Orthodox Church. So when they say, one in, it doesn't say one in being, one in essence. So what the Arians say is that what Jesus is really saying is one in will with God. And so so that this, the adoption is this conferred grace that God gives and adopts Jesus as the Son of God, as we can all be sons and daughters of God. And that the key property of God is not essence, but will. Though he does not know the Father's essence, the morally changeable Christ attains sonship by participation in the Father's will. So it even says in Scripture that Jesus doesn't know the essence of no one knows the essence of God, but Jesus knows, the Son knows God's will, and knows what is expected. And because of his identity with creatures, the sonship that is thought of for the Redeemer can and must be thought of for the redeemed. And so what the Arians talk about is a saved Savior. And where that happens for the Arians in the whole Passion story, I mean, Jesus continues, he goes through the temptations and he passes that test. He goes through other places where he makes choices and makes the right choices. The Arians are willing to say that God foreknew that he would make the right choices. That's why he created him.
Didn't make any wrong choices?
That he wouldn't make any wrong choices. But that he could have. But God God didn't say that he wouldn't, but God foreknew that he wouldn't make any wrong choices. And so where it culminates for the Arians is at the Garden of Gethsemane, where Jesus finally says, not my will, but yours. And so for Arians, that's where the salvation happens, right there. What happens on Friday is an unjust act done by unjust people for unjust reasons. And the death of Christ does not save anyone. What saves them is making your will one with God's will. And that's where the redemptive power, and it's that will understanding that then results in the resurrection.
So where do we see those influences today? Or do we?
You see them in some of the more recent feminist scholarship on the critiques of the atonement. And I have to say that I was the first one to write that, those critique back in 1984. I wrote an essay called For God So Loved the World? ?
Right.
And it was a critique of the classical views of atonement, plus also the contemporary views, some contemporary views of atonement, Dr. King's, Edgar Sheffield Brightman, who wrote a book called The Finite God, and Carter Hayward, who was also a feminist theologian, and critiqued them all, saying that at some point they all have to have God responsible in some way for Jesus' death. And that the and the central metaphor in my essay is that is divine child abuse.
Right.
God the Father demanding and carrying out the suffering and death of his own son. And no wonder we have such an abusive society, because the central image of the society is an abusive image. With that. In my little bio on the wall, when I say I was 24 hours away from being fired for heresy, it was for writing that article.
Mm-hmm.
Because the provost dragged out the Constitution of Pacific Lutheran University, which I don't think he'd ever done to anybody else who'd ever written anything, that said that all scholarship had to be done in accord with the scriptures and in harmony with the Lutheran confessions. And this clearly was not.
Maybe someone can educate me,
understand.
Or maybe it's going too far down. Where is the Lutheran tradition in that? I'm not familiar with that. Where does it conflict?
For Luther, there's a centrality of the cross.
Okay. Salvation through.
Yeah. And pretty much a substitutionary atonement understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Which, quite frankly, is the same as Wesley. Substitutionary atonement is that Jesus dies for our sins, in our place.
But you're saying in your article that God participated?
No, that God had nothing to do with Jesus' death, and that Jesus' death doesn't save anyone. It's an unjust act done by unjust people for unjust reasons.
Repeat the Garden of Gethsemane part.
So that the salvation part happens when you make your will one with God's will.
That's in the Lord's Prayer.
Yes, and
thy
it's
will
it's
be done.
And it's in it's, and it's the it's not my will but your will. And when Jesus finally comes to that understanding and realizes and says that I will not give in to the principalities and powers. I will continue to preach. He's not at the Garden of Gethsemane choosing death. He's choosing life. He's choosing to stand up to the principalities and powers and continue to preach kingdom values instead of worldly values, knowing full well that people will kill him for it, probably. Just as Dr. King knew that he was going to die because he refused to stop preaching what he needed to preach, even though he had threats. Jesus had threats against his life. He was not stupid. He knew what was going to happen. But he makes the choice for life, and at that point is executed for doing that. That's the point of the article. It's a really strong critique of substitutionary atonement. That we owe a debt to God we can't pay. Because we're born owing. We're born with original sin, therefore we're born owing. And we just keep sinking lower and lower and lower as we live with that. And so that it's the argument that Anselm makes in the 12th century in his book Cor Deus Homo, Why Does God Become Human? God becomes human because the debt is owed in humanness. And it can't be paid in any other thing but humanness. But no human can pay the debt because we're all born in debt to begin with. So you have to have a perfect human who doesn't owe anything and in fact has probably merits to pay with it, and so dies in our place to pay the debt that we cannot pay. Because God, being a just God, cannot just say, oh, never mind, guys, I'm sorry you sinned, but that's really too bad. But because God is a just God, God needs to be appeased somehow with it. That's substitutionary atonement, and it's the classical view of atonement, understanding.
So I didn't want to get you way off.
No,
that's where this thread comes from. That is
some of it comes from this understanding of an Arian Christology, of working with that, so that. For the Orthodox, the way that we're saved is or the way that salvation happens, is that the Son is exactly the same as the Father, is of the same substance, the same essence. If in fact divinity does not touch all of this human thing, then that human thing cannot be saved. So it has to be of, this is, it'll get into a little bit later, Christological controversy in the 5th century about fully human, fully divine, what part of Jesus is human and what part of Jesus is divine. And that gets into, I use little food metaphors for that. The one view is what I refer to as the peanut M&M theory, where the Jesus' soul is divine, but the flesh is human. So it's, you know, the peanut is the divine part, and the chocolate part is the human part.
Delicious.
Yes. But the problem with that one is that if, in fact, the divine part doesn't touch the flesh part, then it doesn't get saved, and that's not acceptable. So that didn't work. Although it actually is Athanasius' point. He writes about Hermos writes that Jesus does not have a human soul. With that, the other one is Nestorian understanding, and it's a popsicle theory of Christology. If you ever, when you were little, did you have a red and a blue popsicle? Did you ever get those popsicles?
Yeah. With two sticks.
Two sticks. Yeah. Popsicles on two sticks. One's red and one's purple. One's red, one's blue. They never melted into purple. And so for Nestorius, the human side and the divine side are stuck together like that, but they don't mush together. So that you can figure out what part is, some part is human and some part is divine. The one that wins is called the communicatio idiomaton, which means that everything communicates to itself, which I refer to as the marble cake theory of Christology. Because when you have a marble cake, you mix in the chocolate swirls and the vanilla, you can't cut a piece of that cake without getting chocolate swirl and vanilla. You can't get little pieces of it. And so that's the communicatio idiomaton. I always make my students hungry when I teach, and they're worried about. So those are my food metaphors for Christology. But what the Arians are doing is that salvation comes from the key property, which is sharing the will of God, not the essence of God, and that there was a time when He was not, because He's the firstborn of all creatures. Now, what usually the critique is that Arius is lowering Jesus, or lowering the Son. And in reality, what Arius is doing is raising humanity to the possibility. And there are places in Paul and in other places where, in fact, said you can be gods. And all of the adoptionist language in Paul, it was just in the Ephesians passage a couple weeks ago in the lectionary, that we are all adopted as sons and daughters of God. And so the Arians picked that language up and say that...
sons and daughters, then heirs.
Then heirs.
Yeah.
With that. I happen to like it because I'm adopted. It's one of my favorite. It's always been one of my favorite passages. As an adopted kid, I know that helps you understand that you are part of a family, even if you're not of the same being with your mom and dad.
We've been spiritual, journaling, working, and just kind of learning about it. And we were breaking apart the Lord's Prayer and writing about it. And our Father who art in heaven. It's not just Jesus' Father. Mm-hmm. Plural, possessive. I mean, it just, I had never thought about this before. I mean, this is what you're saying right here. He is. Jesus taught us that. And it kind of just, I went, our Father.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one of the other key things is the changeability. God for the Arians and for actually most of the Orthodox folks is unchangeable. the Greek word is atreptos, unchangeable. And Arians are willing to say that Jesus, or the Son, they don't actually talk about Jesus, they mostly talk about the Son, is atreptos as well, unchangeable. But unchangeable in that sense of the conveying the infection of rather than a commonly shared substance. So when they tried atreptos, which they did in Nicaea, the Arians were like, sure, fine, no worries, atreptos, I can go with that. They tried all kinds of words that the Arians kept saying, sure, great, till they got to homoousia. And they just absolutely couldn't go with that at all.
I'm a little ignorant, but did St. Augustine write anything about this? Did he address it?
No, he's a little later.
Yeah, I realize. He must have been known about this controversy.
Oh yeah, he did. And he was very Nicene in its understanding, but he was busy running against other people. He figured this one had been settled.
Okay.
Even though there are and the Arian dating of Arian folks and things is really complicated, because there's Arians and then there's semi-Arians, and as I said, the Germanic tribes are mostly converted by Arian missionaries. Because it really was an incredibly popular movement. And part of the reason it's popular is because it puts humanity right in the center of their own understanding of salvation. Is that they have something to do with it. And it's not just some capricious God who either does or doesn't save you. Depending on if you have an understanding of election, which... does in Romans.
So, do I need to ask a question?
Yeah, what, please.
It strikes me, like, let's say to the Gnostics, right? I'm sorry, but they're just a little hokey with all the secretness, and it doesn't seem like a cohesive movement. You can mm-hmm. see how it got written out of, or how it lost the battle, and who got to write the history of the Christian mm-hmm. church. But this doesn't seem as hokey to me. I mean, as you said, it's popular. You can see where it comes from. It seems to hold together.
And it really never dies out.
Okay, so I was going to say, like, can you give us a vision of politically what was happening and how its success
yeah.
was?
Yeah, Constantine had just fought a civil war with two other people that wanted to be emperors. And so the empire had been divided into three parts. If anybody was at the Shakespeare lecture yesterday, where King Lear is going to divide his mm-hmm. kingdom into three parts, I always go, that's the Roman Empire. Constantine fights this battle, and he defeats everybody. He defeats one person, and then at the Milvian Bridge in 313, the night before this big battle for that he's going to fight at the Milvian Bridge, he sees a sign in the sky. That in the sky. And it says, and words underneath it that say, by this sign conquer. And it's actually kind of more like this. Which is sorry, that's not very well drawn. Which anybody in Christian symbology knows that's Cairo. Priestus Rex in Latin, the Christ the King. And so Constantine sees that sign, and with the sign, with by the sign conquer. So he has that painted on everybody's shield the night before the battle, and he wins. So he says, aha, this is pretty good. Really liking this stuff. And so he ceases the persecution of the Christians with that, because he thinks that this nice Christian God has helped him win the battle. And now he is the only emperor. But there's still... Constantine's a really nasty person. He kills some of his sons. and some other any other political rival he can find that he gets nervous about. But what he wants to stress is that there is one emperor. And the way he does that is by using, he wants to use a cosmological argument. As there is one God in heaven, so there is one emperor on earth. And so it's really crucial for Constantine that this Trinitarian, so that it's not looked at as three different things, but that this Trinitarian understanding become one God with three personas, three hypos, in Greek it's hypostasis. And so he wants to push for this, he's pushing this homoousia because of the oneness that he wants to stress for the empire, because it's a very political reason for the empire. I remember one of my teachers in seminary, very large man with very big jowls. He would get red in the face, he'd get very excited. And when he was talking about the Council of Nicaea, he was like, it was political! It was just all political! The jowls would sort of make fun of him, but it was, he'd just get all excited. It was political! It was just all political! With that, but he wasn't necessarily arguing the salvation aspect, but the politicalness of Constantine saying there has to be one God. There's one God because there's one emperor. And otherwise, then his whole mythology that he's surrounding himself with is gone. And so that's part of the reason why he's pushing that. So it's homoousia that wins, and then they send out a lot of people to go out and preach that. That this is what it is and this is what it's supposed to be. And the little light dies. the projector light was still on.
Okay.
I was noticing it. I was like,
he had an M&M on his shirt, too. I thought it was connected with you.
Oh. the sun's identity with the creature is crucial for the Arian scheme of salvation, no less than the orthodox soteriology depends on the possession of the paternal essence by the word alone. So that they both have to hold on to their own understandings, because as I said, everything that's predicated of the Son has to be able to be, everything said about the Son has to be able to be said about us for the Arians. Everything that's said about the Son has to be said about God for the Orthodox. And it doesn't really solve the Trinitarian problem. It just says one essence. And then it doesn't define how that is or how that works. Then we have later on folks writing all these, Gregor of Nyssa, Gregor of Nazianzus, all those folks writing treatises on how the Trinity works. Which are still not very satisfactory about, and there's all kinds of heresies surrounding whether there's God has different masks that God wears, or that God acts as creator and then comes down and acts as redeemer and now continues to act as sustainer. Along with that, you don't get a Trinitarian understanding until you talk about the relationship between them. There's very little that I like about Augustine, I have to say, but I do like his explanation of the Trinity. Augustine talks about the Trinity as the one who loves, the beloved, and the power of love, which is the only Trinitarian explanation I really like. But that the one who loves, the beloved, and the power of love. That's Augustine's definition of the Trinity. I can actually go along with that one. So the Arians, I think when they're looking at as I said, they're looking at some of the scriptures, they're picking out some of the Pauline understandings of Jesus being the pioneer and perfecter. So that's exactly what he is. He was firstborn, monogenes, firstborn, showed us the way to do it. And that's the that's salvation. Jesus comes and shows us the way to live and how to love and shows us the way to have our will one with God's will. And if we follow that and we follow the teachings that are listed in the gospel and go along with Paul's understanding of pioneer and perfecter, then we too will attain salvation and will be adopted as sons and daughters of God. As we can all be. But we have choices that we make.
So, one of the things I've been wondering is, so what did they think about baptism? And was the way that they thought of baptism adoption?
Or? We don't know. Part of the problem is that all we have saved is this little bit, because that's what they were arguing about. And so we have their, we have the Arian Christology. We don't have anything else. What I'm going to talk about tomorrow, we'll talk about Pelagians. I think if you take the Arian Christology and put it together with the Pelagian anthropology, it forms a whole system. But we have no idea what Arius thought about
that. It's just fascinating to me because there really are quite a few different ways of thinking of what baptism means. And the Romans 6 dying and rising that's been so prominent in the West, I think has to do with our obsession with the cross and with substitutionary atonement. But there's in the Bible, there's clearly adoption language about baptism and enlightenment language about baptism. And you get this idea that we're that we're sort of become, that we're, there's this unity with Christ through baptism. So lots of material there to make me think they could have had a really strong theology of baptism that was very scriptural, but wouldn't have fit, you know, the way the Orthodox tradition developed in the West with baptism.
Right, and there is the thoughts of where is the where does the adoption happen?
Yeah.
And there are some adoptionists that say that the adoption happens at the baptism. Where the voice of the dove comes down, and the voice of God says, "This is my beloved child.
I love that.
With whom I am well pleased." And so that's where Jesus is. So some adoptionists would argue that's where Jesus becomes the son. And that adoptionist, and in fact in Mark it's literally the Greek. It says we always have this vision, I think, when we see this, of, you know, the clouds parting quietly and this cute little bird flying down. In Mark, it's literally the heavens are torn open. And the Holy Spirit descends as a dove, but it sort of dive bombs Jesus. It's just this, it's not this nice, gentle little scene. And then again happens at the Transfiguration, where again God says, "This is my beloved." But this time he says, "Listen to him." And that sense of that's what's important. Listen to him.
Will and obedience.
Yeah, that will, that
yeah.
obedience.
Yeah.
That work with that. Because when Jesus is asked, "What do I need to do to attain eternal life?" He never says, "Do you believe in justification by grace alone?" Yeah, really. And he doesn't say, "Do you believe in my death and resurrection?" He says, "Sell all you have, give to the poor, and come follow me." Or Matthew 25, "When I was hungry, you fed me. When I was naked, you clothed me. When I was thirsty, you gave me to drink. When I was in prison, you came and visited me." And it was just, "Hey, man, when did we do that?" Well, when you did it to the least. And that the whole, the new law that Jesus brings is the whole Sermon on the Mount. not just the first 13 verses of the Beatitudes, but the whole Matthew 5, 6, and 7, all of it. That sets out a much harder ethic, as we were talking about yesterday with Imogenus, who said there's, you know, Jesus makes the ethic of Moses even harder, and then Imogenus made it even more strict with it. The Arians would go along with that sense that it's very clear, it's not like a mystery what we're supposed to do, it's pretty well spelled out. It's not like God's hiding it. It's not like the Gnostics with the secret kind of knowledge you can find. It's pretty clear. And it's not easy, but it is possible. And it's possible because Jesus did it and showed us the way and showed us how to do it. And because he was firstborn, monogenes, we are also created after after this first creature. We are the same creature as that first creature. We can, in fact, follow that, and that's how the salvation happens. It's two very different understandings of salvation. One where humans have a whole lot more to do with it, and one where really you have nothing to do with it. That I need to tell you is not the traditional understanding of Arianism, but I think I really am convinced. I have, if anybody wants it, I have the article that Greg and Groh wrote first before they published their book. And if you wanted to look at the whole argument for the salvation versus radical monotheism, I'm sure we could probably find somebody to make some copies for folks. It's a really old article because I got it in seminary, and I'm really old.
I know we're going to be running out of time, but can you state the lines in the Nicene Creed that specifically rule out the Arians?
One in being with the Father. That's pretty much the specific. It's God from God, light from light, true God from true God, begotten, not made, one in being with the Father. Those are the words that define the Arians out. But it is particularly homoousia that defines, because the Arians were going along with everything else. But homoousia can't do it. Not same essence, not same substance with it. And there were a number of bishops at the Nicene Council that voted against the creed. And they got up and left. And then they sent out all these other missionary folks to start preaching the creed. And then saying, if you couldn't say this creed, then you didn't belong in the church. We're not exactly sure what happened to Arius. We know that he dies shortly after the Council of Nicaea. One of the Orthodox stories that they love to tell about what happened to Arius is that he was literally exploded in a bathroom.
That's horrible.
I mean, just, you know, like threw up and diarrhea and all this, literally just, you know, which quite frankly leads me, if that's true, that he was poisoned. Because he was incredibly popular. I mean, he was the one person who could have, with his really incredibly popular preaching, prevented that Nicene creed from being adopted by a majority of the people with it. But Athanasius tells it's Athanasius who tells the story in great gory and gleeful detail. And says that it's the punishment of God for spreading this insidious heresy. So he's not killed by the Orthodox Church, but they really, at least openly. If Athanasius is true, I think he was poisoned with that. So
As the week goes on, one of the things I'm finding myself asking is if we find any evidence from the Gospels for treating divergent belief as an excommunication offense. Like, does Jesus give us, would Jesus say yes to calling people heretics and excommunicating them? And if not, is the act of calling people heresy itself an unchristian act?
It depends on some of the ways that you would interpret things, and particularly in John. When Jesus says, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me."
Yeah.
But also in John it says, "I have sheep that are not of this fold."
Yeah. Yeah.
And the sheep know my voice.
Yeah.
It's in that whole Good Shepherd passage. And I always lift that up to folks. It's like, Jesus said, "I have sheep that are not of this fold."
Yeah.
So, everybody doesn't have to be in the same little pen with us sheep here. There could be other sheep over there that are Jesus's as well. With that. So I think that I mean, even the I am the way, the truth, and the life, even that is, the Arians pick that up and say, see, that's exactly what Jesus is saying. I am the way and the truth and the life. That's how you get to life, by following my way.
Being one with that.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, and you think about the other sheep parable, you know, Jesus wasn't worried about the 99 who were all set. He was like going after the one who was over here somewhere out in another area, trying to make sure they were okay.
Yeah, the Orthodox Church says that's what they're doing with heretics. Is they're going out to find them, and if they can't find them, or if they can't bring them forcibly back,
slaughter
them.
Yeah.
Just like my son, he's a theology student. He told me, I was concerned about how churches behave and that, you know, even the synod the bishop is, and his dad. He says, you got to realize, you got God, the church, and religion. Not all three are on the same page all the time.
There's a my favorite and it's parallel to, and when they will leave, it's parallel to what when Jesus is asked what the greatest commandment is. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, your mind, your soul, your strength, and your neighbor as yourself. Rabbi Hillel, who's a first century rabbi, same contemporary with Jesus, was once asked to, was challenged to teach the Torah while stand, can you recite and teach the Torah standing on one foot? And Hillel said, love God, love your neighbor. The rest is commentary. Go and learn. And that's pretty much where I am. Love God, love your neighbor. The rest is commentary. And what the church has built, the theology stuff that the church has built around Jesus, I think if and when Jesus comes back, is going to be appalled.
Yeah.
About some of this. Like, seriously, dudes, not what I meant. How did you get from that to this? I don't have, how did you get there? How did you get to an unscriptural, non-scriptural word as a center of a creed that defines people in and defines people out? So.
Great.
Anyhow, that's my heretic pride for the day. Tomorrow, if you choose to come, because you are good heretics and have a choice of what you do, we'll be talking about Pelagians, which I think is a really good complement to the Arians. As I said, this is the Christology, because we don't have Pelagius' Christology. We only have his anthropology, because that's what Augustine was arguing. So the next two heresies that we have, Pelagians and Donatus, are the folks that Augustine argued against. So we'll get up to Augustine. So we're going to move up a century tomorrow. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome to keep the handouts. If not, you don't have to. I will.